Welcome to Musonomics. I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt and the NYU Sony Audio Institute for Music Business and Technology. Over the past three decades, the music industry has fought to get paid in the digital age. First around piracy, then around platforms. Now it's facing a new challenge, artificial intelligence. This is the second in a three-part series on AI and music. The focus of this episode, litigation, regulation, and monetization. In 2024, the major record labels sued AI music companies Suno and Udio, arguing that these systems were trained on copyrighted recordings without permission. The claim is simple. If you're building a business on music, you have to pay for it. And music publishers sued Anthropic in January for unlicensed use of lyrics to train their chatbot Claude in a $3 billion publishing lawsuit, now the largest non-class action copyright case in U.S. history. The AI companies see it differently. Their argument is that training a large language model is more like learning than copying, that it's transformative and should fall under the doctrine of fair use. At the same time, similar lawsuits are playing out beyond music. But what's striking is that we don't yet have clear answers. Warner Music Group settled with Suno and Udio. Universal settled with Udio, but not Suno. Sony Music has settled with neither, and its fair use cases against Suno and Udio are expected to produce a pivotal ruling this summer that could set legal precedent for every AI music company. So this conversation is about where that line gets drawn between innovation and compensation, and whether it's ultimately decided in court, in Congress, or in the marketplace. David Israelite is the president and CEO of the National Music Publishers Association and a friend of the pod. Judge David Strickler is an economist and one of the three United States copyright royalty judges, joining us on this episode in a personal capacity. Both are adjunct professors at the NYU Steinhardt Music Business Program. And so, David and David, great to have you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with David Israelite. David, what is fundamentally at stake for songwriters and publishers?
I think the future of the music industry is at stake. We're talking about a technology that is more disruptive and has the potential to impact the music industry more than any previous technology that we faced. We're always dealing with new technologies and disruption. That's nothing new. But this fundamentally changes the nature of how music is created and whether or not people who make music will still be able to have a career, a job, to make a living by doing so. When you have these machines that have basically stolen the entirety of human history of music creation and now potentially want to compete under unfair rules, you're looking at fundamentally the future of the music industry.
David Strickler, what do you think are the core legal questions that the courts are being asked to decide?
Well, I think, Larry, you touched on the major one in your introduction, and that is the question of fair use. The AI companies are hitching their legal wagon, so to speak, to the concept of fair use. They're saying that training their models with inputs of songs and generating new output from those inputs constitutes fair use, and we can get into all the elements of fair use in a bit. But that is the primary argument. So if you have a good fair use defense, generally speaking, it means that you can basically get what some might think is something for nothing, which is that you can utilize the musical input in a way that you want, but you don't have to pay for it, such as, and we'll, as I say, we'll get into it in a bit, but with regard to, say, a parody. When someone uses an existing song as a parody, such as Two Live Crew used a Roy Orbison song in the past, Pretty Woman, when they could demonstrate it was a parody, they didn't have to pay a royalty for it. So AI is trying to analogize to other categories of that satisfy fair use. And the question is whether the courts are going to allow that.
So let's talk about fair use directly for a moment. Judge Strickler, what is the strongest fair use argument for the AI companies?
Well, the strongest fair use is to focus on one of the particular factors. There are four different factors that go into fair use. And their argument is that it is what is called by the courts as transformative, that the use is sufficiently different in terms of value, expression, meaning, message, purpose. And as a consequence, they are creating new value, and they have a right to do that without having to pay for what they put into it. Now, that's their strongest argument, is to focus on factor one. There are four factors, but the next most important factor is considered factor four within the list within the statute itself that creates the affirmative defense of fair use, and that is that it can't be done with regard to if it has an effect on the potential market for the value of the copyrighted work they're utilizing to create that. And the courts have leaned, for the most part, most recently, I think, with the Goldsmith case, which involved the Andy Warhol Foundation, they've leaned more towards saying that anything that is going to interfere with the commercial use is going to have a difficult time satisfying the fair use standard. Not that it can't be overcome, but that's going to be a rather difficult hurdle to cross. And I think that's where the parties probably line up with regard to the AI companies emphasizing that that their use of musical works and sound recordings is transformative. It's new. Certainly the concept of artificial intelligence, generally speaking, is incredibly transformative. But whether it's transformative in the sense of the affirmative defense of fair use is a different question, I think. And then, of course, the copyright owners will be leaning on the fact that there's a commercial harm here. And that's before we even get into some of the economic issues as that really lay behind some of these legal points.
David Israelite, what is the strongest rebuttal to the fair use argument?
Well, Judge Strickler is correct. Fair use is a case-by-case analysis, first of all. That's important to understand, that every one of these cases is going to have to look at the specific facts and make a judgment on a case-by-case. You're not going to have a court ruling that applies in a blanket way across all these different circumstances. Two of the four factors, one of which the judge just mentioned, have to do with the idea of substitution and the idea of the effect on the market for the original work. And I think that there is a very strong argument that when you look at what some of these AI music companies are trying to do, is directly replace human-made music. And so if the attempt is to create a mass volume of new songs, new recordings that do not have a copyright, but rather are produced by AI, and put them into situations to draw away the eyes and ears of consumers, that directly impacts the royalties that flow to the songwriters and the artists that make human-made music, then I think those two factors within a fair use analysis are going to strongly weigh against them being able to successfully argue that what they're doing is fair use.
I think David beat me to the punch by getting to an economic argument right off the bat there when he talked about substitution, and he's right, that's a very important aspect. But just to play the advocate for AI for purposes of this discussion, AI's rebuttal to that, as I understand it from looking at their submissions to the register in preparation for the register's report when they made their public comments, their argument is that if there's a substitution, it's a substitution of songs in a style that will conflict, perhaps, or substitute for songs that are otherwise copyrighted. But there is no copyright for a style itself. And their argument is when they do the statistical analysis and break down individual songs and reconstitute that as different music, what they're doing is trying to copy a style. They might not deny that it's a copying of a style, but they'll say the style is not what's copyrighted. And I think that's their argument. And that argument, as far as it goes, as best as I can see it, makes sense. The question is whether it goes far enough. The problem is that the fair use statute and the fair use concept never contemplated this. It never contemplated something such as AI. So the substitutability is there, but of course the substitutability exists All songs themselves are differentiated products, one from the other, and they were all competing against each other. And I think AI's position is, well, this is just going to be a lot more songs being done by highly sophisticated algorithms that have been created. And therefore, they're entitled to be to do this because there is no copyright protection that we're violating when we create substantially similar styles. I think that's their argument.
David Israelite, what's your rebuttal to the argument that this is really about musical styles which are not subject to copyright protection?
Well, I'm sure that's what they're going to try to argue, but I think it ignores the reality of what's happening in the marketplace right now. And so when you have, for example, if you look at some of the search engine cases, for example, the famous Google Books case, where the argument was made about fair use for what Google was doing by making snippets of all of these books available. That is very different in that what Google was not trying to do is produce entire books, fill a competing Barnes & Noble's bookstore with alternate versions at a cheaper price, and draw customers into a different marketplace of these types of books. That's not what they were doing. That is what these AI music companies are trying to do. I mean, we've seen some streaming fraud cases already where people will produce AI music. They will then use machines to try to drive traffic to that and then try to get paid the royalties that would otherwise go to the human beings that should be paid those royalties. And so, yes, it's true that you can always, you know, have different types of songs within genres. But that's not really what we're talking about when you have machines that are attempting to mass produce non-copyrighted songs and flood the commercial products such as the streaming services or the short form video services where people go to enjoy music and replace human songs. And so I think that while that will be their argument, I'm optimistic that the courts will see through that for what the true intent is of what some of these music AI companies are doing.
Separate from the litigation questions that we're beginning to unpack, David Israelite, do you think that 100% AI-generated music should be demonetized or deplatformed?
I think you have some really interesting questions, and it's probably helpful to divide those questions into different buckets. I think of them in really three different buckets. You have a legal bucket about what the law says today, and it's going to be a very long time before we get clarity about what the current law allows or doesn't allow. You have kind of a policy or legislative bucket about what governments or policymakers might do in response. But I think the more interesting bucket is the third bucket, which is the commercial and the business bucket, about what happens in terms of real decisions by market players about what to do. And so I think right now you see that tension with digital service providers, what they do with AI music, should it be labeled? Should they pay out any royalties at all if they can identify it? Whose job is it to identify it? Those are things that we're struggling with right now. But what I'm optimistic about is you're also starting to see licensing. You're starting to see AI music companies voluntarily enter into licensing negotiations before the courts have spoken, before the government has acted, because they recognize that they want to do and be more. And that requires a partnership with actual music companies. And so to answer your question, you know, I don't think that AI music should be generating any royalties. It's not copyrighted. But I do think that we need to have a cooperative effort with the people that make the music, the people that deliver the music to consumers, about labeling, about identifying, about credit. And that's a discussion that's ongoing.
David makes a very good point when he says the third bucket is the most important one, the commercial bucket. I would call it the commercial slash economic bucket, but it is the same bucket. And one of the practical concerns, and this is getting to the economics of it a bit, and the economics of bargaining here, and I'm the economics judge on the Copyright Royalty Board, so I always tend to see things from this perspective. But if the AI companies were allowed to succeed on their fair use argument, as I said at the outset, they get something for nothing. There's no bargain. There's no need to bargain. You've got something for free. You just use it. Now, AI ain't going away. It's there, and AI music will be around. The question is, all that value that will come from it, whose it going to go to? Now, one of the arguments when you look at the transformative value cases is that you have a situation where there is a recognition that there's added value. That's what's the transformative aspect of AI, that it is a value that is added. But if a value is added, that implies that there was a value there before to which it added. The value that was there to which it added was the value of the underlying song, the musical work, or the sound recording. Now, if there's going to be a sharing of that, that sharing is going to happen through negotiation. If you give either side the opportunity to keep all of it for free, there's no negotiation. And since added value implies a surplus created by both parties, if we're talking about two parties here, then there has to be a negotiation. And apropos to that, David points out that there have been negotiations. And to expand on his rationale as to why that is, I think the government may be doing everybody a bit of a service here by doing absolutely nothing, by creating what is known in economic circles and in commercial circles, I think it's the shadow of the law, whether it's the shadow of the legislature or the shadow of the courts. You don't know what they're going to do. And if I'm in David's shoes, for example, and I know that there's a risk, you know, if the law goes against me, that suddenly, you know, all of this value is going to be taken from us by AI, I'd rather cut a deal than take that risk, depending on how I feel about the risk. Obviously, it's an uncertain situation. And AI, too, they recognize the power of collectivized copyright ownership. And if they have to negotiate, they're going to have to share that surplus in a way that's going to be driven by hard bargaining by the National Music Publishers Association, by the major music labels, the music publishers themselves. They'd rather not get it. They'd rather, to state the obvious, get something for nothing. So I think the government at all different levels is doing a favor by forcing bargaining. And David may recall from the Phonorecords 3 litigation, which was not involving AI at all, something that was advanced was the bargaining room theory, whether there should be rates that were set sufficient to allow for bargaining. The judges didn't necessarily agree with that in that particular case, but it certainly seems applicable here when the counterparty is not streaming service, but the counterparty is AI trying to get something for nothing by its particular application of the fair use law. So I think bargaining has to take place. And for bargaining to take place, you would think if the courts and the legislature are sufficiently interested in the economics of this, they would require bargaining.
David, what could a licensing system look like?
What it looks like right now, which is voluntary licenses negotiated between private actors in a marketplace. It's already working to a certain extent when you have willing parties on both sides entering into licenses. And we've seen a handful of them. I suspect there'll be many more in the near future. And that is the best way to go about it. Not a government-imposed solution, not a blanket opt-out solution, not artificial rate setting, in my opinion, but rather let market forces determine what the value is of the exchange. And I think that Judge Strickler is right in that if one party were to win outright, the bargain would be very different. We're both negotiating with somewhat of an unknown as the court cases proceed and as the government hasn't acted. But I think it's very analogous to a previous situation, which is instructive, which is when we were dealing with the early days of YouTube, and YouTube was taking the position that it was protected by the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and that it wasn't responsible for the copyright infringement that its users might be posting on the site. They were just a dumb pipe that they had to take things down when asked, but they weren't responsible. YouTube settled with the NMPA, and it was the basis of a licensing deal that, fast forward to today, they've paid more for music rights than any company on the planet. Yet they won their lawsuits when they carried out the Viacom case until the logical conclusion. And I think what we learned from that is that what YouTube determined is that even if we win this lawsuit that NMPA had brought, we can't get to where we want to go. We want to be a more vibrant business that does things that is bigger than a dumb pipe that lets people post their cat videos with music behind them. And so I think that some of the AI companies are coming to that same conclusion, that even if they were to win some of these legal fights, what are their limitations and where do they really want to go? And that's why I think the market approach to it is going to be the most effective way we get through this period, as opposed to waiting for court cases or waiting for the government to act.
Judge Strickler, your thoughts on whether you foresee a market-based approach rather than one imposed by the courts or Congress?
I thought there would have to be something imposed because I thought, you know, to the extent that both parties would be at loggerheads and would not be able to negotiate, some sort of third-party intercession was going to be necessary. But I agree with David. There's more and more licensing going on. He has his own particular explanation, rationale. It's certainly a reasonable explanation. I tend to see it more as parties dealing with the uncertainty. And the surplus is so big. Why fight and roll the dice and see what's going to happen to you? Why not just cut a deal? There's enough there for everyone. And bargaining theory suggests when everybody's going to gain from the position they're starting at, they're not going to avoid the bargain, and they'll sit down and bargain, given their own relative strengths and their own willingness to walk away or not walk away from the table. And the more of that you have, as I think David is pointing out, the more of that you have, the more that's proving that you can have a licensing in the marketplace. Now, again, I think that's created by the shadow of uncertainty, but it really doesn't much matter why it's created. Once you have enough of that, you have a thick enough market, shall we say, that parties have an understanding of what value is in the market, and they know how to negotiate to the extent the information is not confidential, and they can negotiate. But now, for example, now in the cases that we have before in the copyright royalty board setting, we notice the tremendous value that any collectivized licensor has, whether it's in sound recordings or in the underlying musical works, and that needs to be offset if one takes the position that we've taken and that the D.C. Circuit has approved, that there is this disparity that has to be remedied to get to the rate. Now, if AI cried about that as well, these are very big companies and highly capitalized companies. I mean, they could cry about it, but some of them are also the streaming services themselves, and they could say that the copyright licensors are just simply trying to utilize their specific market power to drive unfair bargains, and then they could be in a position to make the same arguments that streaming services, satellite services have made, that led to the imposition of a statutory compulsory license. Whether they would succeed, who knows? But they don't know that they would succeed. Discretion may be the better part of valor and cutting a deal. So I see the market growing because of uncertainty, but if it's growing because they want to be more, like YouTube did, as David said, that might be, those are not mutually exclusive ideas, and they're all combining to create a market. And if a market can be created, and if there's not disparate a bargaining power on both sides, and there's no statute requiring any particular type of bargaining power, have at it, let the market work.
David, you are a veteran of many litigations and settlements. Do you think this is headed toward settlement in the near term or prolonged litigation? What do you think?
I think both. I think there's going to be litigation for a very long time on AI issues. And I think at the same time, you will find specific companies making the decision to enter into business relationships, licensing agreements. And I think Judge Strickler's right that part of that motivation is the fear of the unknown. But I also think it's this theory that I am putting forward, which is the desire to be able to have the functionality and do the things that you want to do. And so, for example, when YouTube made their settlement with us and then later won their lawsuits, they could have reversed course. They could have said, when our current licensing deals expire, we don't need them anymore because we've already proven in court that we can be a DMCA compliant service and just take things down. They didn't do that. And the reason why is they were interested in professional content. They got into television. They got into sports. They got into all kinds of things that they saw as growth opportunities that required partnerships. And, you know, there are many AI companies out there, but I've spoken to some where it's clear to me that they're going through the same thought process of what if we got away with fair use training and could just be this platform where people could make music without us having to do anything? That would be our limitation. What else would we, what might we want to do? And why not partner and be something bigger? And so I think both motivations can be there.
like David, I also teach as an adjunct, Larry, at the NYU Steinhardt School. And one of the things I always try to tell students, I also teach at the law school at a similar course. And what I always try to do it, and even as a judge, I try to identify the underlying human condition, the human urges that are behind things. Because economics can make it sound so complex, and law can be full of Latin and confusing terminology. And I think it's important to be able to explain it to people in a way they can understand. And there's a battle between greed and fear in these situations, as there is in a lot of investing in the future, whether it's in financial markets or here too. The greed, if you're looking at it from the AI point of view, is let's get it all, as I said before, let's get it all for nothing. The fear is, what if we don't? Then what happens? So maybe if we try to drive the bargain, that fear of losing out completely, fear of missing out, isn't that the expression these days, FOMO, by the students? Fear of missing out, we're not going to get a royalty. So if we're not going to get a royalty, then copyright owners say, maybe we better bargain for the best royalty we can get because we have this legitimate fear. But if we did get a royalty, then we can use all that collective power and hold out. And if there's no statute to stop us, well, that's what businesses and that's what trade organizations are supposed to do. Trade associations, they're supposed to get the very best for their constituents they can. So that's exactly what they should drive for. And so there's fear on both sides. There's greed on both sides, which is not uncommon. And I don't say that pejoratively. I'm not saying parties shouldn't be fearful. I'm not saying they shouldn't be. Greedy does sound a little pejorative because it's kind of unfair. It's maximizing returns. It's not meant to be critical. It's meant to say that you're doing something delicate and there's uncertainty. So you can't, you're not going to succumb to fear and you're not going to seek to acquire the most you possibly can given the risks. So I think that's where the parties are, and they're trying to figure that out. And consistent with what David said, every negotiation will be different, in part because everybody has different aspirations. As you said, David, YouTube tries to be want to be more than just what it was, is a dumb pipe. And other companies maybe are just very happy to try to keep doing what they're doing, and everybody has different risk tolerances. And that's how it shakes out. And that's business.
David, the settlements that have happened in the marketplace seem somewhat encouraging so far anyway. At what point do you think Congress would have to step in, if ever?
You know, I'm not counting on any help from the government. I think that our government looks at AI development like an arms race that has national security implications, economic security implications, and anything that is a speed bump, they're going to want to flatten. And I think copyright is a speed bump in the development of AI. And so while I would love it if the government would step in to protect songwriters from what's going on, I'm not counting on that because I don't think it fits within the much larger kind of motivations of what's going on with AI. Now, I do think there are some things that we might hope that government would do. One of them has to do with transparency and the training methods. I think it's important beyond just copyright or music that we understand how these models are trained, and there's a government interest in that. And that's something that would benefit, especially if it turns out that they're not able to rely on a fair use defense as they train their models. So that's one important thing. I represent music publishers and their songwriter partners. From the recording artist side, there's obviously a lot of concern about name, image, and likeness issues, and we're wholly supportive of those efforts to make sure that what is often a state law issue might get addressed on a federal level about protecting that. And members of Congress have the same concerns. You can imagine what might happen in campaigns with deep fake videos of politicians saying things and doing things. And so you can really make an argument that hits close to home for a lot of legislators about that. So we're not counting on government to help us out of this situation. In fact, I'm more hoping they don't do anything harmful to the situation, which would be things like expanding the fair use analysis or mandating some type of compulsory licensing or opt-out system. So if government stayed out, that's probably best case scenario right now.
Judge Strickler, your sense of whether, when, or if Congress might ever get involved?
Well, generally speaking, I don't try to predict what politicians will do. Specifically with regard to this Congress, I definitely do not try to predict what Congress is going to do. I mean, to the extent any Congress is beholden to special interests, I would have to know which special interests they're beholden to, and then I could predict. But since I don't have any crystal ball or inside information in that regard, I can't. But interestingly, what I will say is, when I try to teach, again, to go back to how I try to teach this to students, I tell them about when I first became a copyright royalty judge. Now it's about 13 years ago. And I decided I was going to try to be an expert on, especially since I was the economics judge, I'd understand the economics behind each rate setting structure. And I tried to figure out the consistency behind each element of the structure, and I could find none. So what I tell the students is, let me save you some time. Don't try to figure out what Congress was thinking from a sophisticated economic point of view. Just understand that it's every Congress, it's every different Congress deciding to patch a hole in some problem that's come before them, and they do it. So sometimes in the industry, the marketplace rules, and other situations, it's regulated under this standard, and in other situations, it's regulated under that standard. And that there's no good economic explanation for why they did it that way, but that's what it's like. So don't try to use your analytical capabilities. Use your ability to memorize, and that'll be the important thing. So I know the short answer is I don't have any understanding or prediction as to what Congress is going to do.
David, I remember in the early years of YouTube and the other user-generated content platforms of that era, that it would have been an unfair question then to imagine many years in the future when someday YouTube, for example, might become the professional content delivery machine that it has become now many years later. But I'm going to ask the question anyway. What do you think this space evolves to, not in 15 years, but in, say, 3 to 5 years?
I'm actually optimistic that despite the threats that this technology poses to the music industry, that it's also an opportunity for growth. The music industry has been evolving at a rate that's exponential compared to the past. And I think one of the things that was learned through the era where online file stealing was going on and the music industry was at least slower to respond than it should have been is that a lot of lessons were learned through that. And what I see now is a music industry that is not such afraid of change that they're not willing to jump in and embrace and try to figure out ways to make it work. And that's what's going on, I think, with AI right now. The deals that are being made are scary for a lot of companies. They're not exactly sure where this is going, what the impact will be. They have creatives that they represent that are nervous about the impact of the technology. But I do think that there are enormous opportunities with this technology if done right. And I think that's reflected in how much you're seeing the value of music copyrights being transacted in the marketplace today. These are very smart investors that are deciding to put a lot of capital into trying to own these music copyrights. If they thought that the future wasn't bright, they wouldn't be doing that, or the prices would be going down. And that's not what's happening. And so I do think that we're optimistic about the near-term future, but like a lot of these transition periods, it doesn't mean it's not going to be without shedding a lot of blood to get to the place where you have the peace. And so I do think it's going to be a volatile next 3 to 5 years in this space, but I think the market is going to largely figure it out. And I also think there's a huge question about consumers. Will consumers ever embrace this kind of competing, non-copyrighted, non-human music, or will there be a backlash against it to the point where it's out there, but no one really wants to engage with it? And that's something that I think is a little bit of an unknown, is how consumers react to it.
I agree about that, about how it affects the artists and how the consumers are going to deal with this. And one of the things I do in my classes is ask the question, do you think that that AI music should be permitted? And I'm always a bit surprised that the consensus answer is no, should not be allowed. And my response to them, whether I'm playing devil's advocate or not, is that, well, why, if somebody else wants to be able to listen to that music, likes that music, or can access that kind of music at a lower price, why should your tastes get in the way of them doing that? And quickly, I try to steer them into the idea, and I think, David, you might have been alluding to this, the idea of labeling, which has been a big contentious issue. And, you know, there are people who say, I don't want to hear a song from a machine. I don't want to hear a song from an algorithm. I want it to come from the heart. I want to know that a person suffered in life or was inspired by something, and this is coming out of them in the song, and that touches me. And that's a legitimate desire. I mean, who's to say it's not? One of the things, you know, economists dress this up in the dry vernacular of, well, we don't make interpersonal utility comparisons. Well, it means, who am I to tell you what you're supposed to like? You like what you like. You're not hurting anybody, so you, that's what you want. But if that's what you want, there should be a labeling requirement. It's not unlike, but not completely analogous to the whole idea of growth-modifying hormones in food. Well, they may hurt, they may not, but as long as people really don't want it in there, maybe there should just be a label, and then you can pick whatever you want. So why shouldn't people, and students don't really seem to have a really good answer as to why, once they hear that, their taste should be predominant, and yeah, that labeling makes sense. Now, with regard to the artists, switching over to the artists is an interesting issue, because AI music, presumably all other things being equal, is going to be cheaper to produce than artist music. Artists require care and feeding and advances and a whole host of things that they need to be able to live. The machines have high fixed costs. They really apparently don't have great marginal costs like human beings who need to sustain themselves. So if I was an artist, I'd be very, very concerned. And, you know, when I read the comments that were proposed or introduced into the record, and when the Register was soliciting arguments or comments, AI companies would commonly use this sort of statement, and I always sort of wince at it. They say, well, when we deal with our artist partners, you know, but what it looks like they want to do is replace human music completely. And so to say that partnering, that's sort of like the lion capturing the antelope and saying, let's sit down and figure out what we're going to have for dinner tonight. We already know where that meal is ending up, and it's ending up in the belly of the lion. So there's a real problem there. And of course, that's an agency issue, as between the music publishers, the sound recording companies, and their artists, as to how that gets handled. And the artists will have to make certain, as long as that's their the relationship that they're depending upon, that they are protected, whether it's from an opt-in option for the artists or not, or whether or not there's a guarantee for the artists, or will they all be replaced? And eventually, new music can be just generated from old AI music, and the artist becomes irrelevant, unless, of course, now to circle back to the consumer says, I'm not having any of that. I want my music from human beings, and I'm going to pay for that privilege to have that. And then, of course, that market will exist.
David Israelite, what are people, fans, music industry people, professional prognosticators getting wrong about the AI subject and the AI litigation at the moment?
I think one of the things they're getting wrong is the idea that AI and human creators can't both succeed at the same time. I think that there is a world where that can be true. And I think right now it's often pitted as a one or the other. And so that would be one thing that I think is getting mistaken quite a bit. Second thing is, I think you have to be honest that the interest of songwriters differs in some ways than the interest of record labels and artists. In some ways, AI music has the potential of breathing a lot of new life into songs that are still copyrighted, but different versions of them. So if your favorite band of all time, you know, the Beatles, and you could make every song ever written sound like it was a Beatles song with permission, that would breathe a lot of life into other copyrights that have new versions, for example. And so there can be some tensions about that. And, you know, right now, I think that the sound recording and the composition side have been mutually supportive of each other's goals in AI. But I think you have to recognize that at some point there could be different points of view and different things that they're pursuing. And then finally, we spend a lot of time talking about the need to license. I think it's just as important to talk about when you do license how that money gets divided. It is unquestionable that the song is more important in the training model than the recording. And so I believe that any licensing deal should reflect that. And we'll see how they play out in marketplaces, but I will be a very vocal proponent of the concept that it should reflect the true value of the training. And in that value, you talk to the AI companies themselves. They will tell you the song is more important as an input to the training model than the recordings, and the economics should reflect that.
Because I hadn't really thought about the distinction between the value in this context of the sound recording and the musical work. And David, the way you're describing it, if I wanted to find an analogy, I think I would be looking at sync rights. Because in synchronization, the movie company is not particularly interested in having the original artist's version of the song. They'll have to pay too much for it. But that's not what's driving ticket sales. What's driving ticket sales is the overall movie, and the song is part and parcel of the background of the movie. So they want the song. And there was even an argument going back to the Phono Records 3 case as to looking at the ratio of sync rights, sound recording rights to musical works rights, because there is a difference with sync rights and with AI. That's what they want, arguably anyway. They want the underlying music, and they'll get whomever can sing it electronically, or whether another band will repeat the AI music, as apparently is happening now to some extent. But that's a really good point. That ratio of sound recording rights to musical works rights in terms of royalties is really scrambled from what it might otherwise be if you're looking at an ordinary streaming service type of royalty allocation.
Let's agree that the rules are not yet written. The outcome will matter a lot for creators and rights holders alike, and for the AI companies themselves. And let me say, David Israelite and Judge David Strickler, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you both. It was very enjoyable.
Thank you, Larry.